If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is MPB News.
Hi, this is Karen Brown. Thanks for checking out the Mississippi Edition podcast. If you like what you hear, click subscribe, hit like, or leave us a comment if your app has that feature. Then find other MPB podcasts by searching MPB Think Radio on your favorite podcasting platform. Thanks. Good morning. It's 8:30 on Friday, January 8th. I'm Karen Brown, and this is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. On today's show, a record high in COVID-19 cases elevates health professionals' concerns over an already stressed hospital system. Then the chair of the House Homeland Security Committee reflects on the storming of the Capitol earlier this week. Plus, the latest State of the State survey reveals a drop in the governor's approval rating. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. Mississippi has a new high record in daily coronavirus cases. This comes as the Department of Health reports 3,255 new cases of COVID-19 yesterday, showing signs of a surge that health officials predicted would follow the holiday season. Dr. Mark Horn is president of the Mississippi State Medical Association. Horn tells our Kobe Vance he feels as if residents have grown numb to the high numbers.
When you look back over the past 7 to 10 days, you see that we have a steady increase in number of cases on average. Bottom line is, it's bad. What does it mean for the state of Mississippi? Well, it means that we're not getting better. We're getting worse. It means that each of those cases, we know that there's about 10% of the people who test positive will end up in a hospital. So that means that on average, today's numbers will generate just over 300 hospitalizations. We know that of the people that get hospitalized, we know about 20% of those people end up in ICUs. We know that a certain number of those people are going to die. So it tells us bad things about the coming days and weeks. And we've become, I think the average person in the public has become somewhat numbed to the numbers. And that those 3,000 plus names are real people. They're individuals. And I talked to a lot of them. I've been looking at some charts right before we spoke. It scares people. Once it becomes real to them, they're often concerned. Well, am I going to be one of those people who ends up in the hospital? Am I going to be someone who's going to end up on the ventilator? Am I going to be that statistic that doesn't make it? Or that has long-term consequences that last for weeks or months. That's what those numbers mean to me. Those numbers are people, not just numbers.
Some hospitals are having to take on patients, even if they don't have space, in an effort to try to relieve some of the strain off of the state's largest hospitals, because ICU rooms are often full, and managing these transfers is often difficult. What have you been hearing on that field?
I would say that hospitals across the state, I haven't polled all of them, but I would suspect that the vast majority, if not all of the hospitals in the state that manage intensive care unit patients, have more ICU patients than they have ICU beds or ICU staff to care for. I know that there are facilities where we're having to place 2 patients per ICU room in order to care for people. It's common across the state. I would say it's the rule, not the exception, to be holding many patients in the emergency room that simply do not have a place to go in the hospital. And it depends on the size of the facility, but the larger facilities have sometimes held dozens of patients dozens in their ERs for extended periods of time. I had a friend of mine tell me yesterday that at his facility in the central part of the state that ambulances were being told not to unload their patients, to care for the patients in the ambulance for several hours, in one case up to 5 hours before they could have a place to unload them in the ER. So, you know, it's terrible. And this is the rule, not the exception. These aren't rare things. You don't have to search very hard or talk to many physicians that work in hospitals. You'll hear these stories. You talk to a hospitalist, you talk to an ER physician, you talk to a chief medical officer, you talk to a chief executive officer of a hospital, a chief nursing officer, somebody who's got their finger on the pulse of what's going on. And to those of us in the profession, I mean, it's enough to curl your hair.
So what do you see as the next step to try to protect our hospitals, to protect our healthcare system and make sure that at least the people who are in the most critical care can get the care they need?
I continue to say, I sound like a broken record, but I continue to plead with the public to please believe us when we tell you how bad things are. I have several disappointing conversations per week with people that I know are honest, good-hearted people that typically are trying to do the right thing, and they just don't believe what we tell them. They genuinely do not believe this is an issue, and they cannot be convinced. And so my consistent plea with them is to please believe the people that you know and trust in healthcare. When we tell you this is a crisis, it's a crisis. And help us by wearing a mask if you're in public. I know some people don't believe they work. You know, those of us in medicine and public health, we know they work. It's not a big deal. Just put a mask on. It's not a big deal. It's not going to hurt you. It helps a little bit. It helps. It's better than not. We want to help Mississippians be healthier. We want to help them when they need us. But we are facing challenges that none of us could have imagined.
Dr. Mark Horn is president of the Mississippi State Medical Association. Dr. Horn, thank you for your time.
Thank you so very much.
Coming up, the chair of the House Homeland Security Committee reflects on the storming of the Capitol earlier this week. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
Hey, this is Larry Morrissey with the Mississippi Arts Commission. I'm one of the hosts of the Mississippi Arts Hour, the arts interview show on Think Radio. We talk with visual artists, musicians, writers, as well as people who help bring the arts to their communities. We hear about how each artist learned their craft and get some insight into their creative process. You can hear the Arts Hour every Sunday at 5 p.m. on Think Radio, or listen anytime by subscribing to the show through your favorite podcasting app.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Karen Brown. This week, pro-Trump extremists stormed the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. During the insurrection, lawmakers in the House and Senate chambers were first placed under lockdown and then evacuated to a number of undisclosed places. Mississippi Congressman Benny Thompson was in the House gallery when the events began. Thompson shares his experience with our Michael Guidry and says he's joining in the House's effort to impeach President Donald Trump.
At the beginning of the process, we saw the vice president being whisked away from the speaker's rostrum and other people likewise being whisked away. And we were not quite sure what was happening at that point, but we were told that the Capitol facility had been breached by the Trump demonstrators, and so that we should just shelter in place. And then we heard what we thought was gunfire going on. And so at that point, security said, put your gas mask on. Tear gas has been deployed in the building. So in the midst of that, a decision was made to move the members assemble out of the building altogether. And it, for about 30 minutes, it was a harrowing experience. But we did not know until that point that the individuals who had breached the Capitol had gotten to the third floor. Nonetheless, we were escorted out of the building to a more secure place. But the fact that what had been one of the more secure buildings in Washington could be just damaged to the point that windows were broken, doors were smashed, artifacts were taken. It was just not who we are as a nation, and the whole world looked at us and said, I can't believe that the strongest government, the most democratic government, has come to this.
Since the events of the 6th, of January 6th, images of the summer protests against racial injustice that took place in D.C. have surfaced. Those images show a very heavily protected Capitol, a very strong security presence. We all know about the incident in Lafayette Park during those protests where protesters were hastily and violently cleared out of the way. How do you explain the stark contrast between what we saw this summer in D.C. and what we saw this week?
Well, it's a double standard. What we saw this summer in the District of Columbia, the only difference is the focus was on the Black Lives Matter movement. There were black and white people advocating for racial justice and other things, and obviously the Trump administration didn't like it. We had a number of federal law enforcement related agencies there on hand. None of those assets were available when this started. And the problem with it, more than that, is the fact that we are concerned that this could have been a more horrendous situation than what we had. More lives could have been lost. More people could have been hurt. But thank goodness it wasn't. But that breach should have never occurred. There should have been enough assets in the region. And it wasn't like this was an activity that was planned overnight. It was planned shortly after the November election. President Trump tweeted, come to Washington on January 6th. It's going to be wild. And ultimately, he gave a speech to that effect and told the people, go to the Capitol and take back your government. I never thought in my lifetime that I'd see the commander-in-chief attack his own government for exercising the democratic principles of voting.
You know, since the events of Wednesday, we have seen some of your colleagues in the House and then some of your counterparts in the Senate suggest either the 25th Amendment be invoked or that articles of impeachment be drawn up. Based on your position and your observations, what is the appropriate next step in addressing the rhetoric and the vitriol that led to this moment?
Well, January 20th, Donald Trump will no longer be president. Thank goodness for that. I have signed on to an impeachment resolution, however. He cannot get away with these, what I consider, treasonous actions on his part. He has demonstrated he is not fit to be president of the United States. And even though we have less than 2 weeks left before he's gone, you still have to acknowledge the fact that he continues to be willful and neglectful of his sworn duties as president.
You are the committee chairman for the House Committee on Homeland Security. What role do you see your committee having? I know Congress has essentially adjourned its regular business, but what role will your committee have in both investigating the events of this week and looking forward to protection of the inaugural activities on January 20th?
Well, two things. Domestic terrorism comes under the auspices of the Homeland Security Committee, which I chair. This event that occurred was an act of domestic terrorism. So we are going to have to look at it. We'll have to talk to the Capitol Police. We'll have to see where the breakdowns occurred. I have a briefing set up by the FBI and Secret Service on the 14th of this month to look at the security protocols for inauguration. It's obvious now that there are some really crazy folk in this country that bears watching. So I want to hear from the agency professionals what they plan to do. But I'm excited about the Biden administration coming in. He has the experience. He has a wonderful vice president to work on the team with him, with Vice President Harris. So it's time for us to take that deep breath when Trump is gone, which basically, in my estimation, is a sigh of relief.
Democrat Benny Thompson, the congressman from Mississippi's 2nd District, we thank you so much, and we wish you your safety, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
MPB News requested conversations and comments from the rest of Mississippi's delegation. All either declined or didn't respond to our requests. Coming up, the latest State of the State survey reveals a drop in the governor's approval rating. This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio.
For this new year, let's ditch the New Year's resolutions. On average, they only last about 30 days. Instead, let's commit to learn something new each and every day right here on MPB Think Radio. From health to finance and even Fido, MPB Think Radio is your daily source for news, information, and entertainment. So let's make this a year to remember with MPB Think Radio, where Mississippi is our mission.
This podcast is a local production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting and depends on the support of listeners like you. If you can, please donate today at mpbonline.org. And thanks.
This is Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. I'm Karen Brown. A new poll suggests Mississippians largely disapprove of the job Governor Tate Reeves has done in his first year in office. The latest State of the State survey conducted by Millsaps College and Chisholm Strategies reveals a 49% disapproval rating for Reeves. Nathan Schrader is chair of the Department of Government and Politics at Millsaps. In part two of his conversation with MPB's Michael Guidry, Schrader breaks down the governor's approval marks and examines how the state's voters feel about voting expansion.
What we see here is the voters have really soured on Tate Reeves in the first year. There are certain, if we again drill down into the data, we find that there are certain voters, subsets of voters, that are particularly frustrated with Governor Reeves. Those are the younger voters, those who are, you know, 18 years old to 34 years old, and to a lesser extent, middle-aged voters, those who are about 35 to 54. And those who, but he does a lot better with voters who are slightly older. He does a lot better with voters who are Republican. He does a lot better with voters who are identified as conservative. So that's really where he's doing. The people who are much more likely to say that they approve of his first year, his work as governor here at the end of his first year in that office, tend to be conservative Republicans who are 65 and older. And if you want to see where he has especially rough numbers, it's with African-American voters. He's at a negative 49 score with African-American voters. And similarly, whether you're talking about moderate voters, it's negative 47. Liberal voters, negative 61. He's got a lot of work to do to try to bring those people back into the fold and give them a reason to trust him or to think that he can do the job he was elected to do. We also, in the State of the State survey, measure these questions based upon where people live in the state, in the congressional districts in which they live. Governor Reeves has a negative rating somewhere in all those districts between negative 11 and negative 17. And why that's important is we're talking about even the conservative white majority, Republican majority congressional districts, he's hemorrhaging support if we're just looking at the approval disapproval number. That even in these conservative Republican majority congressional districts, he's deeply underwater.
Pulling the lens out and considering the presidential election and some of the rhetoric surrounding the results of that, there is the talk of voter integrity, election integrity, voter fraud, you know, those questions. The State of the State does poll Mississippi residents on how they feel about early voting or other voting measures. What did you find about the way Mississippians feel regarding changes in the election process?
Well, first of all, Mississippians have in our we have polled the question of early voting expansion in Mississippi three times now, in the summer of 2018, in the winter of 2019, and now in the winter of 2021. In each of these surveys, the majority of Mississippi voters, we're not talking about a plurality of them, but a majority of Mississippi voters have outright favored the expansion of early voting in Mississippi. That is still true now. 55% of Mississippians support, they support allowing early voting in Mississippi, which we do not have presently. We're one of the only, I believe, that we're one of the only six states in the country with no means of doing any form of early voting. So Mississippians are ready to do that. And that, however, there's been slippage in just how many Mississippians favor that position. Like I said, there's only six remaining states in the nation that do not have legal early voting. We're one of those states. This number was as high as 71% back in January 2019. 2 years later, it slipped to 55%, but still a very, very clear majority of Mississippians, by 17%, they favor expanding early voting in Mississippi. And I'll tell you why I believe that's the case. I think it's the fact that we have the vast majority of states in the country doing this, and people know this. They see their friends and family and social media contacts on Facebook and other places. Look how we do early voting. It's easy, it's safe, it's convenient. Our votes are counted, and Mississippians, I think, wonder why we're not doing that too. And there's actually strong pockets of support for expanding early voting. Among African-American voters, men and women alike, every single age group of voters show that we break down in the survey, every age range favors expanding early voting. Democrats, independents, liberals, moderates, the only two places where there's opposition comes from conservatives and Republicans. Again, not all of them, but just slightly more conservatives and Republicans oppose this than do others politically.
You mentioned the three times you've asked this question, there has been a majority response for support for early voting. And the highest was in January of 2019, when that number was as high as 71% of voters that you polled supported it. We've seen a 16-point swing. As a pollster, when you look at these things and you try to contextualize them, how much of that drop has to do with some of the rhetoric surrounding the most recent election and the role of expanded voting and mail-in voting during that election?
Oh, that's a terrific question. I think you're exactly on the right. You're on the right track there. If you look in our Mississippi numbers from the State of the State survey, where is the opposition coming from for early voting expansion? It's your strong Republicans and your most conservative voters. So with that said, where are those folks? Just again, I'm not saying anything that's out of the ordinary here. Where do many of those individuals get their information? It tends to be some of these ultra conservative news sources, and it tends to be from the Twitter feed of the President of the United States. And unfortunately, as much as I hate to say this, those entities that I mentioned, the President's Twitter feed and some of these news organizations, they have been promoting a steady diet of unhealthy misinformation about early voting and voter fraud that did not happen in this election. So unfortunately, some of the individuals who I think they're driving that, what you mentioned, that 16-point swing, away from early voting in the last 2 years. I believe that's coming from a very specific segment of the electorate. I don't believe it. I know it because we have the numbers. It's coming from a very specific segment of the electorate. And I would say that that's because of where they're getting their information, what that information is telling them, that happens to be false.
Dr. Nathan Schrader is the chair of the Department of Government and Politics at Millsaps College, who conducts this State of the State survey with Chisholm Strategies. Nathan, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Oh, no, thank you. Anytime, I'm happy to do this and to talk to your audience. And hopefully this will be available on the Millsaps website at millsaps.edu very shortly.
This has been Mississippi Edition on MPB Think Radio. Thanks for listening to the Mississippi Edition podcast from MPB News and MPB Think Radio. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already, and if your app lets you, leave a comment or review. We really do appreciate it. Remember, you can always get in touch with MPB News on Facebook and Twitter, and fresh episodes of the podcast are posted every weekday morning. I'm Karen Brown. Thanks for listening. This is Mississippi Edition from MPB Think Radio.